Hey, this is John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals, and do share us with your friends. The more, the merrier. In fact, you can be in the crowd when we record the Mincing Rascals podcast on October 30th, Halloween's Eve, about 10 in the morning. We're going to be up on stage doing the Mincing Rascals, and then afterwards, my annual Thomas Jefferson show. I think you'd like both. The Rascals and the Jefferson thing. You can get tickets by going to WGNradio.com/TJ. I'm sorry to say there aren't any real good seats left, but I'm also happy to say that it's selling well and there ain't no bad seats in the house. So join us live, WGNradio.com/TJ while you can get your ticks. And thanks, too, to the Joint Relief Institute. They sponsor the Mincing Rascals. Today is Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. It's 1:40 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record every week. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Lisa Donovan, veteran newswoman at the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorn, pundit extraordinary and plenipotentiary of the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly newsletter. I'm borrowing the language from the nomination of Rahm Emanuel to be the ambassador of Japan. The language of that is Rahm Emanuel of Illinois to be ambassador extraordinary and plenipotentiary of the United States of America to Japan. A plenipotentiary is a person who's invested with the full power of independent action. And that is my the power that I wield over the Picayune Sentinel, my new newsletter.
Why Picayune?
Well, the name is borrowed from my late grandfather, who was a eccentric mathematician who published a periodic newsletter for his math colleagues around the world, and he called it the Picayune Sentinel, and it was filled with in-jokes so obscure that only he understood them in most cases. And so I'd asked my father if I could revive that name of the newspaper for my newsletter, and he thought that was a good idea. So
yeah, what a nice tribute. Just, you know, how's the subscriptions going?
Really, really well. I had a really nice rollout. I'm really, really pleased with it. Anyone who wants to be added to the list can just email me and I'll add you. It's ericzorn@gmail.com.
How many folks you got?
I got about 16,000 views so far, getting close to 17,000 for the first issue. So I was pretty happy with that.
That's more than the Mincing Rascals. You should tell the people that read you to listen to us.
I do. Well, in fact,
I have a whole
section about what we talk about so that people can enjoy our takes on
Well, I sent my I registered with my email, so did I miss the last the first and last edition?
You may have, because what happens is sometimes if you have Gmail or some of these other services, we'll take email it's a mass mailing, and they'll shunt it off into the promotions tab or some other tab that's not your primary tab. So you have to fish it out and move it over. And I think the system then learns that you want it there. It happened to me. I realized I was subscribing to some newsletters that I didn't realize I was getting until I found them in my various tabs. So yeah, look for it if it didn't get there.
Austin, did you see it?
Yeah, it was fantastic. I'm really glad that we can read Eric on a regular basis again.
Yeah, no kidding. And by the way, see Eric, too, in the Mincing Rascals podcast session we're going to do on stage at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove. October 30th has now 800 tickets sold, so there's going to be a nice little crowd for us. Thomas Jefferson comes on to stage afterwards. I'll interview him, but I'll bet of the 800, 775 of them are there for the Mincing Rascals.
Pretty soon Thomas Jefferson is going to be warming up for us.
We'll give him 30 minutes, and then we'll just go ahead and take the hour and a half.
He's the opening act for Thomas Jefferson the musical.
You know, it's funny because the guy that does Thomas Jefferson, he is a Jeffersonian, so much so that he doesn't appreciate – he doesn't like Hamilton, and he doesn't like that in the play Hamilton. Jefferson is a comical figure in a way in that, and he doesn't like that. It kind of cuts close to home.
I feel like all news is good news if you're a founding father impersonator in terms of, like, cultural moment that's arrived, regardless of who it was for. That's funny.
I think they prefer the term interpreter. They don't like to be called impersonators.
I suspect he's the same, particularly since you know, his voice, for instance, is more resonant and deeper than Jefferson's voice. He was very quiet, very bashful, didn't have a great voice. And my guy does.
And one of the biggest slave owners of his time.
Yeah, it comes up a lot on the show. They'll say, you said all men are created equal. You owned a lot of them. So what's up with that? And then he he does the best he can. You know, where it really gets tricky is Sally Hemings. Sometimes mm-hmm. people get ticked at him about that. One time, a woman in the balcony, I can just see her there. She stood up when we went to the questions from the audience. She had a book in her hand. She said, this novel was dedicated to Sally Hemings and the injustices wrought upon her by you, sir. And he got pissed off. He said, how dare you? You don't know anything about my private life. I never left a written word about it, and very little is still in the historic written record. So what do you know our relationship was like? And he kind of gave it back to her. I've done enough of these shows to I know this is also the Jefferson take. It's none of your beeswax. My private life, my personal life, if you're talking about Sally Hemings, is not your private life or personal life. So judge me on tax code or something like that, but not on my relationships.
Yes, I was raping my slaves, but yeah, let's move.
Don't
let's
judge
move.
Me on that. Yeah.
Let's move on.
He'll say, I deserve your rebuke. Of course I do. People are complicated creatures. I'm able to have the vision and the Declaration of Independence that I espoused, and then I owned people. A third, though, of the original Declaration of Independence was struck by Congress. They wouldn't have signed it otherwise. And in that, he said, we need to put language in here that disowns slavery as we have it in this country. He could have done it privately, but he didn't do that either. Okay. Lori Lightfoot calls it blood money. Seize the assets of gang members, she says. Their cars, their guns, their money, their baggy jeans. Is this desperate window dressing, or is there some teeth to what the mayor is proposing? She says the gang crimes are more organized these days, and these suits could lead to the actual adults that are running the gangs, which isn't how I understood the gangs to be operating these days. I thought they were more fractioned and that there wasn't much organization to it. Eric, what are you thinking about what the mayor's proposing?
Well, I'm thinking that it hasn't been proven to work elsewhere, as I understand it. This hasn't really put a dent into gang activity, and that a lot of these young people who are in gangs don't really have that much in the way of assets that you can get your hands on. That I don't have any principled objection to it, but it doesn't seem to me like it's going to be very effective.
Our producer here, Aleph, texted me saying, Austin, you want to go and talk about this policy on John's show? And I said, I have no clue how this in practice would work. You should call the ACLU. Maybe they have some concerns about it. But honestly, my only sort of top line thoughts immediately were around the issue of asset forfeiture, which we've worked on at the Illinois Policy Institute in Illinois, especially civil asset forfeiture. And what that means is essentially before someone is convicted of a crime, police, just because they're suspicious of something someone's doing, can take their stuff. And that leads to a lot of overreach. Like if someone's carrying around a lot of cash for some reason that they need to bring to a family member, they can, all of that can be taken. Oftentimes this happens with people's vehicles and not able to go to work because say their child was driving recklessly and the cops take it, or driving drunk. And there's definite concern with overreach there. And it does appear to me to be more of a ploy for a positive press hit around doing something about crime than any kind of substantial solution.
I saw one of the aldermen said something along those lines. They are already worried that the city's going to use this beyond the stated intent, that they'll be too aggressive with this, or that the police would be.
This is the approach of a former federal prosecutor. Eric, I think you just said it, that gangs are much more, sometimes they're just organizations and people who ally with each other for various reasons. They went to grade school together. These are not sort of the gangs of the 1990s that we're seeing anymore. These are groups that kind of come together. You've got folks who are largely, they're not buying yachts necessarily. Maybe if you go high up, it's all cash and it's stashed somewhere.
Yeah. Some of the things that I've heard concern expressed about this has to do with the inaccuracy of the gang database that would have to be used in order to effectively file these suits. I also want to echo Austin's concern with the civil asset forfeiture. It's an issue that really can unite the left and the right, that police officers will. And remember, these are before a judgment is issued. And the example that Austin gave of a car, someone carrying a suspicious amount of cash, the presumption of innocence vanishes. They seize the cash, and sometimes they can seize the vehicle and sell the vehicle. And so the incentives are all there for things to go really badly wrong.
Right.
I just, you know, I mean, like I say, I understand the anger at the gangs and the situation here, but I also think that this is not, does not look like a very effective way to address the crime of violence.
Well, if it were your only tool, but it's just another tool in the box. I mean, weigh the good against the bad here. I don't think the police are going to go out of their way, or the city's going to go out of their way to abuse it, though abuses can happen. I mean, why are they doing this? But they want to cut into the crime problem. So, you know, I'm leaning into it. I'm just not very optimistic about it, Austin.
In my head, I'm thinking about, as Lisa was talking about, the crime syndicates of old that were almost more like well-run corporations that you could go after through the legal system and make some kind of dent in their assets. You know, what we're talking about is sort of a decentralized, fractured mayhem of many warring factions, block by block. And I don't think you're probably going to make a big dent in their ability to wreak havoc by trying to take their assets in court.
And you mentioned the ACLU. Somebody just mentioned the ACLU. I think that they've already spoken on this, much like what happened post 9/11. All of these laws to address this are on the books, but then we try to create these other laws that potentially infringe on people's civil liberties.
Yeah, I keep thinking of that book, Gang Leader for a Day. And back then, the gang leaders did have nice big cars, and they may have actually had a house somewhere, and it was well appointed, and they did have assets. When this idea first was floated, I thought, oh my God, that's all we've got. As things get worse and worse and worse, and now we say, well then we're going to go after their stuff. I'm like, they don't have any stuff. Bunch of punks driving around shooting up town.
One of the discussions I will say is sort of like everyone's sort of going after them. They don't know what they're doing. I mean, I do think that it is a matter of poor communications with the public on the part of the police department and the mayor's office. I mean, you have to keep trying different things to double down on this sort of asset seizure law that's in place to sort of say we're gonna focus on that. I don't think there's anything wrong with at least taking a look at it.
When this came up on my show, we were talking with one of the aldermen about it, but we were also calling her about the idea that the city should ban, well, not ban, make it more difficult for you to get plastic and paper goods when you order takeout food. And a lot of people said on my text line, why are we worried about this trivial stuff? We should be cracking down on the gangs. We should be doing something about the crime. You can do both, for crying out loud. But that's the sort of thing you get when that comes up. It is kind of an interesting idea. Under the headline, A Forking Good Idea, written by our own Eric Zorn, Eric reminds us that an ordinance was approved by the City Council Environmental Protection Committee on Tuesday. If you want plastic utensils with the carryout and delivery meals from local restaurants, the restaurant is supposed to ask if you want them. And if you say yes, then they put all that stuff in there. The same for condiments. Not so for drive-thru, though. So that ton of garbage you get at Portillo's is still going to stay in the bag. This is so Chicago City Council to me. But maybe it's not a terrible idea.
I do like the idea, and I don't know what the objection to it is, since there's no penalty associated with it. It's almost more of a strong suggestion, because a restaurant can't be fined if they throw extras,
correct,
plastic forks and plates and so on into your meal. When we get meals delivered to us, or when we get carry out, they always put a lot of plastic crap in there. And you would think that a lot of people who are getting this are eating it at home, where they have their own cutlery, their own plates, their own napkins, and it is a waste. I imagine that it is a very, very small amount of the landfill every year goes into making room for the forks that you don't need, and that it's not a huge problem with energy production to make these things. But it's one of those things that it makes sense, it's symbolic, and I think it also gives a restaurant an excuse not to do it. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's like, it'll ultimately say, if since there's no penalty involved, it's going to save them money. If the Thai place that we got carry out from the other night doesn't have to put these things into each bag from people who don't need it, over time, that's going to save them some money. So I think it's and also, and if some customer complains like, hey, you didn't give me any forks, they can say, well, it's a city policy that we don't do that. So don't come to us and act like we're being cheap with you. This is a good idea. So I don't see any downside to this.
I did talk to a couple people behind the scenes in the restaurant world. It does add up. It is expensive. I don't know, when you go to like a Wendy's or a Burger King or whatever, McDonald's, do you get a knife or fork in there?
I don't think I've ever ordered a dish that requires utensils from any of those places.
Right.
So I think
you get a straw. You get napkins. Yeah. You get salt and 52 ketchups, something like that.
Yeah, there is so, that. There is so, that.
So Austin's telling us he's never ordered a salad from McDonald's.
That's exactly right.
The way it would work is when you use this service, they're supposed to ask you if you want it, and then you mm-hmm. decline. So if your complaint is that they didn't put it in there, it sort of is on them because they have to pay attention to your answer. We can learn. I mean, look how we adapted to the bag policy in the city, where if you better bring your own bag or they're going to charge you 7 cents for each plastic mm-hmm. bag. And I don't know, that was new for us, and then we learned it. I heard from some listeners who listen to us in California, and they said when they come to Chicago, they are amazed at how much trash we generate per person.
Yeah. I still go to the grocery store, and people just are like, 7 cents. Give me 3 of them. You know, they don't care.
But, I'm that sometimes. I mean, I do like to have the option, because Brenda and I probably have 400 permanent bags, you know, mm-hmm. good bags that cost us a dollar or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're always at home or in the other car. I forget to walk in, and I go, what the hell?
You will see me carrying it armful. I will not buy
I that. Do that now. Sometimes I'll like have a bottle of wine in my hand walking out, and a loaf of bread and a watermelon, just perilously balancing them as I go to my car.
Well, something interesting, though, about that bag policy is, you remember there was a window of COVID times where they wouldn't let you bring your own bags. And in that case, plastic bags were really important, I think, for a lot of people to be able to get their groceries home. I wish the city council would take this approach on more issues. I read the ordinance, and also Eric didn't see anything in there that would penalize businesses if they don't do this. But if they want to promulgate, hey, this is what we think of as our preference as a city, and we're going to work with the Chamber of Commerce and restaurant associations to say, hey, this is a good idea. If you want to save money, ask customers this or that about their preferences. I think that's totally fine. No one should have a serious issue with that. Now, of course, you could say, oh, it's a slippery slope. Next thing you know, all they got to do is tack on a fine to that at the end. And maybe that could be true, but that's a fight for a different time.
Well, in some ways, isn't it like the vaccine mandate that President Biden imposed on big businesses and on federal government employers last week, where it really gave the employers who wanted to impose a vaccine mandate but weren't sure how their employees were going to react, it just gave them an excuse. It gave them, you know, you point to say, well, you know, it's really not up to me. The president says you got to get vaccinated. In the same way, a small restaurant owner can say to a complaining customer who doesn't get their fork in a bag and say, hey, you know, I would love to put the fork in your bag, but the city says that I'm not supposed to do it unless you ask for it. So don't blame me. Blame the city council. Blame Mayor Lightfoot. And that, even though that is what they wanted to do all along. And I realize that any time you're not addressing the most serious problems of our city and our state, that you can be accused of trifling and, you know, in things. But this is the same thing that I would get when I would write a column about something that wasn't earth shattering. It'd be like slow news day, huh?
You don't have to worry about that when you're just pushing out a newsletter, though, right, Eric? You don't have to worry about nasty feedback in your columns.
I've sent a lot of nasty feedback already.
Oh, good.
And I've had to block Austin. No, I'm debating whether to put a comment section in or a mailbag section in or something, because interacting with readers is always really fun, except when it's not, and it just becomes ugly and mean-spirited. So, and that's why most newspapers now have gotten rid of their comment sections.
Yeah.
Because they just become cesspools of bile.
Look at what happened at the Glen Ellen Grade School, where Kids are supposed to wear masks. Some of the kids are walking with their masks to the school. It's across from the administration building there. And so maybe that's the target for the protest. But now you've got the grade school kids going to school. And what it sounds like is they have to go past a group of protesters who are yelling at the kids and the parents walking their masked kids into the school. And then the parents start yelling back at the protesters. Now they're trying to find a buffer zone to mitigate these warring groups. I'm hearing the descriptions of people getting agitated and yelling at each other about masks. When I go into stores these days and it has a big sign, you have to wear a mask, and then you go in there and there's some mope walking around without a mask on. He saw the sign. He knows. He doesn't care. And my own reaction to that these days is, I don't care either. If you're not going to wear the mask indoors, I'm not going to call the police or the manager and have you kicked out. I'm vaccinated.
I think regardless of where you fall on whether there should be a mask mandate in the school, and I think this goes to sort of the Biden vaccine mandate as well, regardless of the content of the policy, it does matter. The power from which officials are drawing to make those decisions matters a lot. And it's very different from suggesting to businesses that they ask people whether they should have utensils. They're using the full force of government to impose a policy decision. And in the case of the school mask mandates, we just saw a hearing of the Joint Committee of Administrative Rules yesterday in Illinois. It's a 12-member body, 6 Republicans, 6 Democrats. 10 people were there, and they unanimously told the Illinois State Board of Education, you guys need to come back with justification for these rules,
yeah,
which I think was entirely appropriate. And again, Democrats and Republicans both voted for this. And I think it's the same thing with the Biden vaccine mandate. Whether or not you think forcing people to take vaccines is a good idea, whether or not you think the courts will or will not sign off on it, you have to think about representative government and how in the United States, or should in the United States, one person be able to impose his preferred policy preferences on a really large scale on a lot of people, whether the policy is good, bad, or you're indifferent.
I'm glad you brought that up. I talked to John Curran, the Downers Grove Republican, a state senator, about this. He was one of the critics of the sort of difference. For instance, he said public schools, they get a couple of months to interact with the state before they actually lose their accreditation, before the kids don't have a valid diploma, before they can't participate in sports. I didn't know that. But he said the private schools, the Timothy Christians, they lose their prerogative overnight. And he said, if nothing else, it should be the same. And I said, well, should it be 30 or 60 days, or should it be a very short window for which they would have to demonstrate they're complying? He didn't have a perfect answer on that. I don't even think he knew, but he said it should at least be consistent. I agree with him on that.
I am all about school mask mandates. I think they're a good idea. They're going to help stop the spread of this terrible pandemic. I'm for vaccine mandates as far as the government can take them. I realize that there are some questions about how much power you want to impose in terms of policy administration on somebody. But you have to look upon this, as I think the government now is, as a public health emergency and something that you're going to have to. We've tried cajoling people. We've tried rewarding them. And now I guess we're just going to have to try forcing them to taking this vaccine and to wearing masks in public to stop the spread of this pandemic that is going to be harmful to the education of our children. It's going to be harmful to tons and tons of businesses. And there are a lot of businesses out there that we're really counting on being reopened by now, that this was time for us to be back. The economy was supposed to be back and booming. We're all supposed to be without any mitigations. And now we're seem to be heading backwards right now. There was news story this morning that Southern Illinois has no space in its ICU beds. And we've had something like 5,600 students in Chicago public schools ordered to quarantine. And if this gets worse, as the weather gets colder, this is going to hurt all of us. Even if we're vaccinated, even if we're not going to get this disease, our economy is going to suffer. And our children are not going to be educated. There's all kinds of secondary effects that I think government does need to address and needs to treat this like, I think, the emergency that it is.
Makes you wonder why somebody would take the job as the Chicago Public Schools CEO, right? Walking into this, you must really want this job, I guess, if you're going to take this job. I guess in that field, it must be one of the great jobs in America, right? What's it, the second largest school district in the United States? And Chicago's a yep. great city, so what a plum for you, but wow. What a tough job to walk into.
He's a CPS-educated administrator. I mean, you may feel sort of this full circle thing. Look, I sat in those chairs this is what hasn't been fixed since I sat in those chairs. This is what needs to be fixed. I mean, it's a tough job, and especially up against a very powerful union. I wish that the two sides could somehow come together.
This is Pedro Martinez we're talking about. We just hired him from San Antonio. And one of the criticisms is that he's never been a classroom teacher. I don't think that the kind of problems that the Chicago Public Schools are facing is the kind of thing that requires like intimate knowledge of classroom pedagogy, that you have, that is sort of a massive business and organizational problem. So I don't hold that against him. And maybe this is a chance for a little bit of a reset of relationship with the union and CPS, that they can, you know, use this as an opportunity to sort of, you know, say bygones, and let's see if we can how we can figure out things going forward. That's a hope that I have.
We'll see. Janice Jackson was also, I believe she's a graduate of CPS, and she wasn't able to sort of find that way to sort of undo the gridlock.
I'm talking to her tomorrow, Lisa. Do you have any suggestions for me? Because I'm going to ask her what advice she has for him. Martinez coming in. I wonder what she would have done differently or what she should have learned.
I think she's a candid person. I'm not saying her in particular, but I wonder how candid any former CPS CEO would be about their boss drives a lot of the conversation, their boss being the mayor. And when their boss sort of takes over the battle, that can be difficult too. I wonder if she would sort of reflect on what is this organization supposed to look like? Would it be better if the mayor weren't the boss and they were able to sort of be the boss?
Well, the idea that CPS was said, look, we're going back in. Everybody's back in the schools. It's going to be hard to opt out. We do not have a hybrid plan except in extraordinary circumstances this year. I don't have a problem with that. I still think it's, somebody called my show this week and said, should I send my kid to school? Is it safe enough? And I'm like, well, that's up to you. But if you do the math, yeah, it's safe enough.
I think I probably would have answered it the same way. And I think interesting questions for Janice Jackson, who by all accounts, widely respected person, really bright, really incredible talent, and got absolutely nowhere but the CTU. And I think there's a couple of questions I'd be interested in. One is Chicago Public Schools too big for one person to effectively manage?
Yeah. Yeah.
And two, does the CTU have too much institutional power in state law that makes it impossible to manage, whether it's scope of bargaining, the power to strike, which does not exist in any of our surrounding states and in most states? Does that power just totally tilt the playing field too much in favor of an unelected power?
In setting this up, they said, well, she doesn't want to be critical of anybody specifically. She doesn't want to kind of do what Lisa said. I will report back to you in our next podcast. How about that? Let's talk about Alderman Jim Gardner for a second. Lisa, why is he in the news?
This week, I think things kind of came to a head for him. He is now under federal investigation for, I guess, what we would summarily say, perhaps pay to play. This all stems from allegations that he was telling people that they should not provide ward services to political opponents living in his ward. And a lot of this started with Northwest Side group that has the website, the People's Fabric. They reported on a lot of back and forth texts between him and a former staffer in which he referred to women by names I will not repeat here. When that was reported and called out, he apologized. But as that started to come out, that name calling and so forth, then we got into sort of some of these texts about refusing ward services, mm-hmm. and some payback.
It's funny. That's the second part of the story, too. The first one was the B word and some of these other things.
Yeah,
I'm like, dude,
right,
how stupid are you? Especially if some of this other stuff is going to be the second story. Don't give him the first one.
Right.
He's a human being who has sinned, as he said in his statement to the council yesterday. A couple of things. First of all, I got to really tip my hat to People's Fabric, which is an anonymous collective online. And they're the ones who really drove the story out into the open. And Block Club picked up on it, and then the major publications and major news sites picked up. I mean, Block Club is becoming a major news site already.
It is,
obviously, his language that he used is, despicable, and he has apologized for that. And I don't think that is necessarily a career-ending move, even though it was very strong and sexist in some places. The accusation that he used his power to hold down the initiatives of his opponents. Is an abuse of power allegation is very troubling, and the fact that the FBI is allegedly looking into it is ominous for him. On the other hand, I will offer you Alderman Ed Burke, who is under indictment and is still on the council, which illustrates that there's really not much we can do, that the city council can do, that citizens of Chicago, voters in Chicago can do when you have someone who is, you know, a rogue alderman. Gardner was elected. I live about a block away from his ward. I'm right on the boundary here. And, John Arena, who I liked pretty well, was voted out by NIMBYs. People don't, not in my backyard people. Mm-hmm. So this is what they got. And this is what they're going to have for the next 2 years. I don't see any way that a guy like Gardner, just from what I've seen of him, it was going to resign over these protests. He's going to be on the council until and unless he's voted out, even if he's indicted, as we see with Alderman Burke. He'll stay on the council.
Could I add one thing, though? There is something that could have been done if we're going to talk about Alderman Burke, and the constituents could have voted him out. They reelected him. What does that say about us as a community?
I thought it was really interesting. There are these two stories that you pointed out, John. One was this like really kind of terrible language that he was using, especially toward women in texts. And then there's been since he was elected, these pretty credible accusations of retaliation against constituents, singling out people, denying them services, collected by People's Fabric and others over the years. And I thought it was pretty, I found it unserious when I think it was, there was a Laura Washington column saying he should step down, and it didn't mention any of the stuff about constituent blowback. It was only about language he used in texts. Which, if that's the standard for aldermen stepping down, I mean, 100% of the city council is gone. I mean, these people have garbage mouths, like as any politician does. And so, but this is another case of like, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. This is a guy who has a bunch of little authority in his little fiefdom to deny people, block party permits, and not fix potholes on their street. And if you want a real interesting look into the mind of Alderman Gardner, you go on his Facebook page, and he kind of goes around as this rogue kind of pothole fixer / garbage picker upper guy on specific blocks, and he's very much in the role of I'm a constituent service guy. And guess what? When you're in that role, and someone pisses you off, or you're maybe even he's ambivalent to you, you don't get good city services. And it's not a game we should be playing with elected officials.
You ask, how does he keep getting reelected? I think that answers that question, right? I mean, here's my brilliant idea for what we should do. It would work in the city and it would work in the state. You get to vote for Mike Madigan, even though everybody in the state thinks he shouldn't have had the power that he did. And you get to vote for Ed Burke, even though he seems to have been abusing it all these years. Everybody else gets a micro vote on your congressman or on your alderman as well, because it affects all of us, especially when these entrenched people have so much power. So what if everybody in Mike Madigan's ward district gets to vote for him, but then I get a 1/100th of a vote, and then the whole state could have ganged up on Mike Madigan, and then he would have not been reelected if the whole state said, yeah, you locals get your garbage picked up, but he's screwing the whole state. So how about we all get a little say in this? How about that? Who likes that idea?
Oh, I hate that idea.
I'm going to run that by Thomas Jefferson pretty soon.
I really think that in the big picture, this whole issue of constituent services, it was 2 years ago, 2+ years ago, in the ward I'm in, the incumbent, Alderman O'Connor's, his campaign workers came to our door multiple times and said at one point, can we count on your vote? They knew me by name. I'd never seen them before. They were looking at a clipboard. And when I told them I was a journalist and I wasn't going to share who I was voting for, they said, okay, but how are your constituent services? They would proceed to return two more times and ask my husband the same thing. And again, well, how do you like your constituent services?
Oh, you think it was more of a threat than a questionnaire?
When they come to your door, you've never seen these folks before, and I don't, I wasn't, I mean, Hi, Lisa Donovan. How are you? And walking up to my husband on the street. Hi, you know, and how would you know that? How do you know he was out having a conversation with somebody, I believe, and wasn't directly in front of the house. How the hell do you know who he is? I mean, that's a strange way to sort of put it. And it was very abrupt and it was very off-putting. And I actually asked the guy, please don't come back again.
Yeah, but how do you like your constituent services?
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be a shame if
all of a sudden our
bombed out. It'd be a shame if all of a sudden somebody's garbage didn't get picked up. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and then ticketed for overflowing.
Yeah. Looks to me like you got a violation on the lawn there. The grass is a little high.
Gonna vote November 4th? That's what I thought.
Take a flyer. Eric, you don't like my idea, by the way, of all of us getting a micro vote in other people's districts, huh?
I really don't, John. I really think that we talk about representative government. I think that
that is representative government.
It's not. People down in Cairo should not get to say who the people in Mike Madigan's district or my district represents them in the state house. And I just, you know, if we didn't like Madigan as Speaker of the House, I can't believe we're still arguing about Madigan all these months after he left. But you know, there was plenty of opportunity for the Democrats to vote him out as Speaker. There was plenty of opportunity for the constituents of those Democrats to vote them out if they didn't follow their wishes and get rid of Mike Madigan. And yet the Democratic representatives kept electing Mike Madigan. I mean, the serious answer to your question is that the people in Cairo have the opportunity to elect a representative who goes to Springfield and has a vote in who the next Speaker of the House is. And that's how it happens. Now, I know that it doesn't mean that bad people get ousted, but it is a solution that would make that I could imagine causing problems that are even greater than the problem that inspires you to suggest it.
An Illinois House task force is looking into the state of our state statues. We have four presidents who might claim Illinois as home: Reagan, Abraham Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, and Barack Obama. Now they're examining, as the city is, what statues do we have? What statues do we want? Where will they be? All of that stuff. So they're having hearings and they're getting sort of feedback on that. There's a possibility there's going to be a Ronald Reagan statue on the state grounds and a Barack Obama one too. And I don't have any problem with that. I mean, those are all kind of slam dunks for us. Even Democrats are saying that if we don't agree with their policies, State Representative Mary Flower said Reagan has largely emerged as a positive historical figure, whether you agree with his policies or not. She's a Democrat. I mean, of course we should have a Reagan statue in Springfield or wherever, in Eureka. If Donald Trump, though, were from Illinois, that would be a more interesting conversation for me. Eric, do you have any problems or observations with this?
Well, first of all, I'm not a really big fan of statues honoring people. They seem very—I know they're three-dimensional, but they're sort of a one-dimensional honor. It just suggests that this person is to be venerated, and most historical figures are very complicated. If you might have to strike a deal where, okay, we'll have an Obama statue and a Reagan statue. It is interesting also to me that Reagan, who was very polarizing and controversial in his time, now seems like a fairly moderate, mild person.
who
had proposed some fairly forward-thinking reforms during his time. But in general, maybe there ought to be, you know, there's a rule that you can't be elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame for 5 years after you end the career. Maybe there ought to be like a 50-year time between the time someone dies and the time that they can be honored with a statue, so that we can really take a look at this and say, does history really demand that we honor this person? And it is an honor. It's a veneration. It's not history. Statues aren't history. We saw this in Richmond, Virginia last week when they're taking down Robert E. Lee. They're finally saying, like, look, this belongs in a museum. It doesn't belong along Monument Avenue in a town where it suggests that we worship this man. And there's an element of worship to statues that puts me off. And I'm sure that puts me in a minority in the population, but I understand any reluctance anyone wants to offer about putting up statues to people.
That would take us back to 1971 then.
Yeah, that would be what? Who did Lyndon Johnson? He died when? Probably
JFK
71.
Would be eligible.
JFK would be eligible. I mean, we renamed the Northwest expressway for John F. Kennedy like 3 days after he was assassinated.
Well, we have Barack Obama is the name of, what is that, I-57 south of the city or something like that, right? And I don't have any problem with that.
And that's just weird.
I'm sorry, Obama, it's, 50, it's 55. I'm sorry.
Is it 55?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. But even
so, the Stevenson like, into it.
So the Stevenson becomes the Obama at some point. Obama was a creature of the city of Chicago. He was not someone who lived in the far suburbs. That doesn't make any sense to me.
And it's weird because it's 55 from 294 in the suburbs south to mile marker 202 near Pontiac. It really doesn't have anything to do with. You know,
I don't think Pontiac voted for Barack Obama, by the way.
Well, and I guess the idea was sort of like, well, that's the route he traveled on his way to Springfield. He was there for, what, a minute?
I think it was the available real estate is what it was.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about Gavin Newsom's recall. I did want to touch on that with you guys a little bit before we wrap it up today. In a recall election, Gavin Newsom, California governor, narrowly beat out talk show host Larry Elder and about 45 other people by a mere 28%, asked if he should be recalled. 64% of Californians, last I checked, were saying no, and 36% had said yes. I don't know that J.B. Pritzker would get those sort of numbers, though I'd wager that he, too, would survive a recall. So what was the point of this?
California has a lot of goofy election rules. One of them is this wild free-for-all parallel election that happens during the recall, where I think they had, what, like 48 something, maybe upwards of 40 candidates. And the recall effort went down in flames. At last I checked, they were down like 25 points. It was a total blowout.
Yeah.
But I think partially that was a result of the fact that the top of the ticket, so to speak, of those 40 plus candidates was Larry Elder, who, while a man who is very strong in his convictions, is a complete polar opposite of Gavin Newsom, very unlike what you would have seen with Arnold Schwarzenegger when he became governor due to a similar process. So essentially, I think it came down to it being a race between Gavin Newsom and Larry Elder, not Gavin Newsom and no governor. And that was probably his saving grace, or it helped him very, very, very significantly. In Illinois, I think it would, if it was Pritzker versus no one, Illinoisans are very cynical people and vote no a lot on a lot of things and mistrust state government. And I think Pritzker would have a very hard time versus no one. And most of the favorables we see with Pritzker is essentially the state is completely split down the middle with a lot more fanatic, strongly disapprove than strongly approve.
Yeah,
so I think it would be tough for him. But again, who's the person running against him? We actually had a very interesting new challenger enter the field who will be running against him should he win the Republican primary.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second here. But the way it would be in Illinois, where it's structured as it is in California, is the first question you're asked is, should J.B. Pritzker be recalled? And then if he doesn't get 50% plus one, then it's whoever gets the next most votes. And you're right, who maybe the leading candidate would be a factor in people's answer to the first question. But the first question is, should he be recalled? And in Newsom's case, it was based on his handling of the pandemic. That would be what people would vote on for JB, as well as some other things as well. Would he survive the first question in Illinois, though? Would JB survive that if you were just putting him up? And maybe there is a viable candidate out there. Does he survive that, Austin?
So I will give you a super exclusive scoop because we were doing some polling on policy issues we care about, and the pollsters always want you to add, you know, job approval for the incumbent. And Pritzker was split right down the middle, almost 50-50.
But the thing is that you can't – what they did –
But that's different from an election, I would say. Yeah.
Well, what the Democrats did brilliantly in California was they really did turn it into Gavin Newsom versus Larry Elder vote. Elder got about like 46% of, you know, you take that huge field of candidates. Elder was the overwhelming favorite of the voters who were voting in that. A lot of voters apparently left that part of the ballot blank, which is almost irresponsible if you're hedging your bets. But what the Democrats did was they turned it into Larry Elder versus, or they turned it into Gavin Newsom, the Democrat, versus Larry Elder, the fanatic conservative Republican radio talk show host. And that turned out to be quite successful. And it's very difficult to isolate the candidate from the recall effort from the potential threat of the replacement. I think what happened to Gray Davis back in, what was that year? Was that 2003 when I was when Arnold Schwarzenegger won, was that that field of replacement candidates was not particularly threatening. And people were really unhappy with Gray Davis. And they said, well, let's try something new. And I think what the Democrats did here was say, well, if the thing you're going to try is something new, it's going to be this conservative whack job in a state that was that's basically 2-1 Democrat over Republican. And so but clearly what California needs to do is change its law on this so that if you have a recall election, then you start again and you say, OK, we've recalled the governor and in 30 days we're going to have a general election. Where we get to, because the Democrats didn't even put anybody up. There was nobody in that field, or maybe one or two people, minor people, who were actually serious Democrats.
Well, that's an interesting point, because you might say, but why would they? Why would they put somebody else? They want Newsom. But the point is, Newsom can't win if he doesn't get 50 plus one. So even though he might have had the most votes, if he had 49%, this is my understanding of it, right? He would not be allowed to continue to serve as governor. It would have been the next person. So somebody with fewer votes than even Newsom, if he hadn't got 50%, would be the governor.
At the very least, you ought to have a runoff.
Right. They do so at their peril if they don't have him. But then maybe that undercuts your confidence in the guy that's sitting in the office. You don't want to put up a number two. You want your number one.
And John, you touched on the fact, or maybe Austin touched on the fact that there's a new candidate who just jumped in the race for the Republican nomination for governor in Illinois. That's this West Coast venture capitalist, Jesse Sullivan. I guess he technically lives downstate, but he made his money out on the West Coast.
And he's from downstate, too.
He's from downstate. He's raised more than $10 million already, and there are already three candidates in the race. Gary Rabine, Darren Bailey and Paul Shrimp, Rodney Davis might jump into the field. It seems to me that this is laying the groundwork for a possible entry by Adam Kinzinger. And the only real opportunity that Kinzinger would have to win statewide would be if the MAGA vote, the Trump vote, the hardcore Republicans split their vote among these other four or possibly five candidates. And he's the anti-Trump Republican, and he might be able to slide through the primary with 25%, 23% of the vote, at which point then Kinzinger head-to-head against J.B. Pritzker becomes a fairly interesting race, because he's maybe an appealing or acceptable alternative to Pritzker from a lot of people in the state who are tired of Pritzker but don't want to elect a hardcore Republican.
I still wonder whether it lays the groundwork for Ken Griffin, the global investment guru. He founded that Citadel fund in 1990. He's worth, what, 10 plus billion? I still wonder whether that's a possibility.
Does he talk about his political aspirations, Griffin? Does he?
He has.
He's usually quiet on everything.
He challenged Pritzker on the
progressive tax, and then also in the Supreme Court race too.
Yes, mm-hmm. And on the Supreme Court race, and a lot of people thought that was a litmus test for, you know, Griffin versus Pritzker.
He's just thrown a bunch of money in the campaign of Ron DeSantis down in Florida, which is going to identify him pretty strongly with the most rabid of the right-wing COVID deniers, mask suppressors. I don't know how well that's going to play. I don't know that that's exactly even on brand for him.
Is he that kind of guy? Do you know what this guy's politics are, this new guy?
Oh, well, he's definitely a conservative Republican, but I think he's much more of a sort of country club Republican, or at least that was his image, I think, before this. But if he's going to be jumping in bed with his far right element, which I think Ron DeSantis represents, he's much more of a MAGA guy. I just think you have the possibility that you would have a very fractured field. Jeannie Ives might jump in. I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of Republicans who'd like to be governor, and that could pave the way for someone like Kinzinger to thread the needle and become the nominee.
Sullivan, at least in his first couple weeks of this campaign, has not thrown his hat in with the Trump right. He's framing himself much more as a centrist, someone who can win in the suburbs, which if no one else does get in, if a Rodney Davis doesn't get in, if Kirk Dillard doesn't get in, that gets very interesting, because this guy just basically outraised the entire competition and is not casting his lot with the MAGA crowd. And he could eat up a lot of moderate votes in the Republican Party. So I would definitely keep an eye on him.
Has he been asked about any of this stuff? Does he, where he stands on, say, January 6th, or where he stands on, was the election stolen from Donald Trump? Because that, see, if you say that Donald Trump is not, was not cheated out of the presidency, that puts you at odds with a great deal of Republican voters right there.
And I don't think he's been pressed on those issues yet. My expectation is that he will say that that Biden is the rightfully elected president, which immediately I think would set him apart.
Well, that's really courageous, isn't it? That's valor. When Larry Elder made a concession, he said, okay, everybody, I lost. Newsom is the governor of California, and let's accept it. A lot of people are giving him attaboys, saying, well, that was the high road. You got slaughtered in an election, and you accept the results. Wow, good job, good job. You know, we were playing a lot of on the radio today. You guys have probably seen the clips and heard it, too, is a lot of Norm MacDonald stuff. Unexpectedly passed away for a decade. He was battling cancer, and folks didn't generally know that. And then all of a sudden, he's gone. And all of a sudden, everybody is looking at and re-laughing at some of his stuff, maybe more now than I ever did. I really appreciate – I didn't see him, his last appearance on Conan, and I don't remember his last appearance on Letterman. Those were great television moments, weren't they? That was really funny and powerful stuff.
His humor is probably more sort of on par with what we expect today, and maybe not then. Some of his commentary on O.J. Simpson, the O.J. Simpson trial itself, after the verdict was handed down, he said, well, now we all know murder is legal in California. I mean, that's sort of some of the stuff. And he got the boot from Weekend Update by some NBC exec who was
a friend of O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, a friend of O.J.'s. And that exec denied that was the reason why. But he was sort of unrelenting on that.
He had this sort of I don't give a crap attitude. What you think about this? I'm just throwing it out there. And he was always begging your patience, too. His jokes were famously long. And the first thing I read on one site this morning was a guy dies, goes to heaven. St. Peter greets him at the pearly gates. The guy starts telling him a joke. And 8 hours later, St. Peter finally says, we don't have all day, Norm. And that was just kind of his his M.O., you know.
He is my favorite stand-up comedian of all time. His book is great. He is a genuinely fantastic novel called Based on a True Story that I would highly recommend. And the tragedy of that news about his cancer is that his final Letterman appearance, which is iconic and incredible, like centerpiece of the genre, where he really breaks down and thanks David Letterman at the end, he would have known he was diagnosed with cancer at that point. So I would highly recommend people rewatch that.
Didn't say anything.
Yeah, I spent some time last night watching some clips, and I hadn't watched him in a long time. And honestly, I hadn't even really thought about him in a long time. He has been off the radar, but really an incredible talent and a real loss.
Turd Ferguson. Just say that. I laugh. It just works every single time. Okay, guys. Austin, I didn't know that about you, but nice to know. I'll look for that book. That's really interesting. Lisa Donovan, Eric Zorn, I'm John Williams. We are produced by Ashley Byhun and Aleph Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. Oh, and by the way, and we'll see you guys. Let's see. Today is what do we got? Four more of these before we do it on stage without Austin. Austin, you still can't.
Awesome.
Is that couple still engaged, Austin?
Yeah, it may get called off. They're very COVID conscious, so I'll let you know if that happens.
Oh, wow.
Well, that would be a bad phone call if they're like, it's called off. And I'm like, oh, cool. Okay.
I'm fabulous. Cool with that.
Are we all invited to this? Because I am an infrequent. I'm an infrequent guest on this podcast. Are we all supposed to be there?
We are all not supposed to be there. We are all invited to be there.
We are, okay.
So if you want to be up on the stage, that's super groovy. And if you want a couple tickets for your family or friends, there's still about 100 in the back.
You don't have a VIP section for Lisa's family?
Yeah, there's 8 of us, so bring it.
Ask your family or friends.
They heckle when they drink.
And they drink at 10 in the morning.
And they'll be there. If any of your family or friends want tickets, let me know and I'll fix that for you.
See you.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com.
There is one country that worries me, though. Not Iraq, not Iran, not North Korea. The only country that really worries me is the country of Germany. I don't know if you guys are history buffs or not, but... in the early part of the previous century, Germany decided to go to war. And who did they go to war with? The world. That had never been tried before. And so you figure that would take about 5 seconds for the world to win, but no, it was actually close. About 30 years pass, and Germany decides again to go to war, and again it chooses as its enemy the world. And this time they have that guy, Schrankly, Crankly, that guy, and I'm not even going to dignify him by saying his name, but I think you know what I'm talking about. But you'd think at that point the world would go, listen, Germany, here's the deal. You don't get to be a country no more on account of you keep attacking the world. I mean, what do you think you are, Mars or something? Anyways, listen, folks, this will be my last time on the David Letterman show, I understand. And you know, you guys, we all know that David Letterman was the greatest talk show host who ever lived. But I remember Dave differently because the first time I saw him, I was 13 years old. I was living in. I was living in Toronto, Canada, and I went to a talk show they had there. And David Letterman was the stand-up comedian on the show. And I loved stand-up. And David Letterman did this joke that I told everybody this joke. I love this joke. It still stays with me as my favorite stand-up joke ever. So I'd like to do it for you if you'd like to hear it. He goes, I was on the street the other day, and I saw a garbage truck, and on the back of the garbage truck, there was a small sign that said, "Please do not follow too closely. Another of life's simple pleasures ruined by a meddling bureaucracy, ladies and gentlemen." You remember the old days when Dad would pile the kids in the station wagon and we'd all go out and follow a garbage truck? So anyways, I'd just like to say, I know that Mr. Letterman is not for the mawkish, and he has no truck for the sentimental, but if something is true, it is not sentimental, and I say in truth, I love you. Oh,